From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Advice Show. I'm here recording today from the Citywire Wealth Manager Retreat, where our attendees have just had a lovely lunch. And today we've got Phil Kent, who is CEO of infrastructure specialist Gravis, joining me today. So, Phil, thanks so much for being here.
Pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Great to have you. Phil, I wanted to start off asking you about your talk with wealth managers attending today, which focuses a bit on the interplay between policy and investment strategies. That's obviously become increasingly critical, as you speak about. We have a new Labour government, so what do you make of the new government's approach to growth and investment, which is a big focus for them?
Yeah, sure. So I think we're just over 100 days into the new government, and I think there's a lot to be optimistic about. I think the budget and prospects of that and negative discussions around that have probably put a bit of a cloud of what actually, when you dig beneath the surface, has potentially been really exciting. So the fact that the government has reprioritized net zero energy transition as an objective second only to economic growth certainly feels like a bit of a change versus where we were with the outgoing Conservative government. The establishment of Great British Energy, the National Wealth Fund, capitalised with around $15 billion between them. And we saw some detail earlier this week around how that would interact with the UK Investment Bank, which was good to see. But there's a recognition there that sectors need a lot of investment, and positive that the government have put in some capital towards that. I think the challenge will be how can that be used best to leverage private sector capital, because I think in its own right the public capital isn't sufficient for some of the objectives that we've got. It was positive to see the auction round six, which was the latest contract for difference auction round, so the government's principal mechanism to support new renewables. Back in September, that procured 9.6 gigawatts of new capacity for the first time since the last auction that was competitive. And really good to see capacity being deployed across a range of different asset classes. The immediate planning reforms to remove the sort of de facto ban on onshore wind, I think, has also been positive. And I think there's a wider recognition that planning reform needs to take place more broadly to promote new infrastructure, infrastructure projects. So lots of positive stuff there. I think that there is also pleasingly acknowledgement of the role infrastructure has to play in addressing some of our challenges. So decarbonisation and the ambitious targets that the previous government and actually the Labour government had brought forward, the 2030 decarbonisation objective, for example, that requires a massive amount of investment, and there's a huge amount to do. And then digitalisation as a theme isn't going away. I was struck by a stat someone raised earlier that for every ChatGTP request takes up 8 times as much energy as an equivalent Google search. So the energy demand and infrastructure associated with delivering the digitalisation trends that we're seeing are also real themes. So lots to do in infrastructure. I think lots of exciting areas to focus on.
That digital infrastructure point is really interesting, considering arguably AI is a theme that has exploded in such a short period of time in terms of being just in the common psyche and something that arguably every investor is thinking about now. So that's sounds like it's a really important growth area. Just coming back though to, I suppose, the more immediate future, because there is a lot in that is long term, and it'll be interesting to see how the government, how it plays out, you know, in the coming years. We have a budget in 2 weeks' time, and I just wondered if there was anything that you were expecting or sort of watching closely from that budget in terms of maybe some more clues around the direction of the government.
I think there's a couple of different considerations there. I think the first point is to attract private sector investment. UK PLC has got to be attractive, and I think investors, particularly long-term investors in infrastructure, will always talk about stability and weathering different political cycles. So I think maintaining the UK as an attractive investable destination for foreign investors, I think is really important, and having confidence around the budget and our ability to deliver on it is critical. I think there's then the detail of what's actually said. I think there are clearly some challenges around the government's balance sheet and how large capital projects are funded. We saw some discussions over the last couple of weeks of how assets like infrastructure assets are recognised on the asset part of the balance sheet. And whilst I think that's a very difficult thing to do, it could unlock some more borrowing and investment in a sensible way. And then I think there's the detail of support mechanisms and how they're funded. I think whilst there's lots of exciting stuff that I just referred to, there is probably also needs to be an acceptance that decarbonisation will come at a cost, even if that's just a short-term cost, and ensuring that that cost is equitable and doesn't create other issues like fuel poverty, industrial uncompetitiveness, should absolutely be a priority for government. And it's an unenviable task to balance so many different things and maintain the UK's investable, recognising the need for private sector capital while solving what appears to be a fairly large budget deficit.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. To what extent are you, concerned about the impact of quite a tax burden, and also potentially, if it comes onto the table, some loosening of the current fiscal rules, enabling some more borrowing?
I think if those things or a combination of those things are done in a controlled way, explained and understood, and I think this is where we went wrong previously with the mini budget, where the various UK institutions that exist to provide comfort around those areas weren't adequately consulted, and investors lost confidence. So I think clearly it's got to add up, and I guess in all of that, borrowing to invest, does that create the growth that's needed to fund that is the key question. And the various trade-offs between energy price, if we took decarbonisation as an objective, energy price, energy security and the green agenda, and how you balance all of those things, and then make sure that that tax or the cost is split equitably. And I think that's the key thing, because it shouldn't compound fuel poverty. We still, economic growth should still be a priority, and we still need to find a way of balancing at times those competing objectives in the short term, whereas long term I think there's much more alignment between some of those objectives. So
Do you think we do need to borrow to invest?
Yes, I think so, but I think the key, I guess, a quick question: do we need to borrow more, and are we making sure that that borrowing is for capital investment rather than effectively funding what you'd in an ordinary business called operating costs? And I think particularly around infrastructure, that's often been conflated, whereas maintenance has been labelled as capex, when actually maintenance is just something you should do every year on an asset base that requires it. That's not investment. And I think where borrowing is funding effectively operating costs, if you put the country in a sort of corporate context, perhaps that is concerning, where it's funding capital investment true capital investment from which you can point to growth. And there's a massive multiplier effect to infrastructure. As listening on the radio this morning to Crossrail, which I think this morning won, or the Elizabeth Line won the Turner Prize, and there was lots of discussion on the positive benefits that's had in terms of how many people would move, and thinking about going back about the case that you have to make to build those big infrastructure projects. It's a really difficult thing to measure and quantify and forecast how many people are going to use it, what's the benefit of moving people quicker, less friction, attracting people from a wider geography, what impact does it have to different places? And I guess HS2 has very similar questions. So it's not straightforward, but I think what Crossrail has shown us is the potential multiplier effect and economic benefits of large infrastructure. I think it's a success story, and I think we should be using models like that that can promote growth, and I think for that sort of thing borrowing is fine. But let's be mindful of what that costs and make sure we use it for capital investment.
As a frequent user of the Elizabeth Line, living in very near one of the stops, I would second your point that's been a very positive, project. In terms of our infrastructure investments, what are some of the global policy perhaps geopolitical implications in the near future that you are kind of keeping an eye on, that you're aware of, and that you think investors need to be aware of?
Yes, I think one of the delegates here today, I think, pointed out there's 92 conflicts going in around the world at the moment, which is an extraordinary number, and one we, I think, need to be quite worried about. I think particularly what's happening in the Middle East, the potential for that, as it already has, to impact oil price, that could be quite inflationary at a time when everyone's hoping inflation stays low. And on that basis, assuming rates start coming down. So I think conflict could be a real threat to that. And that's something we need to look at closely. I think technology change is always something we need to be aware of in infrastructure. Some of the challenges we've already discussed, decarbonisation, ageing, growing population, digital infrastructure. There's an element of sort of necessity is the mother of invention, and the R&D that challenges promote. As infrastructure investors, I think we need to be close to where technology is going, both from the perspective of obsolescence risk in our existing investment base, but also where the opportunities might be in the future. I think the various competing support mechanisms around the world have been interesting to see evolve over the last 3 or 4 years. The Inflation Reduction Act in the US, the EU's response to that, the UK equivalents, and you know, we have our own carbon price, we have our own funding commitments. I think some of the stuff we're doing around industrial clusters and decarbonising industry, which makes up around 25% of the UK's emissions, are really interesting, and actually on a global context, pretty innovative and leading in terms of the way risks are allocated and managed. So I think where support is flowing from governments will always be where investors are looking to invest, because a lot of the types of investment we're talking about are not economic without support. So there has to be some form of public-private relationship, whatever that is, capital support, grant funding, long-term revenue support, tax funding, as is the case in the US, to unlock those investments. And personally, I find that a really difficult thing to do. We're a very UK-focused investor, so just staying on top of UK energy policy and infrastructure policy is a real challenge. When you're putting that in a global context, it becomes even more difficult. So I think how different governments are approaching different problems. There's been some excellent examples in India at the moment of how they've promoted toll roads to be built and the kind of mechanism they have there to pass risk to the private sector and manage upside. Looking to some of the challenges that perhaps we had in PFI, their model is the more cars drive, the shorter your concession. So effectively you benefit from higher income, but you have a shorter concession. So some innovative models that have lots of read across potentially to elsewhere. So I think that kind of global context of policy support is important.
It's a lot to monitor and a lot to watch.
There is, yeah, and it's changing all the time, and you know, political cycles, as we've just discussed, lead to different priorities and different models, and all with the constraint of growth and growth as a sort of priority, but then budget constraints, and you know, we're talking about big capital investment programs here, and how the public and private sector work, and infrastructure will always have that dynamic where there's a need to work together.
Absolutely. I suppose it's an ongoing, it's the nature of the markets and it's the nature of geopolitics, isn't it? Yeah. You know, on an ongoing basis. So let's bring it back to the UK. So first Labour government in quite a long time. To what extent, for investors, to what extent are their plans for investment sort of important for them to consider, do you think? How closely do you think investors need to be keeping an eye on Labour meeting its commitments?
I think from an infrastructure perspective, there's certainly an element of staying true to the targets that the government have set themselves. So if we take the 2030 decarbonisation of the electricity grid commitment, which was brought forward by the Labour government from 2035, the reintroduction of no petrol or diesel vehicles sold post 2035. So I think there's, for me, it's probably less important whether or not that target is precisely going to be met. And in the case of the 2030 commitment to decarbonise electricity, I find it quite difficult to see how we achieve that given the scale of change that's needed to the grid, investment in renewables itself, but also the ancillary technologies to manage what would largely be an intermittent system with a lot of wind and solar at that point. But even if you don't believe that's going to be met, I think the direction of travel is encouraging. There's still investment requirement that's going to be needed there. And I think we can take a lot of comfort from that. And frankly, whether it's 2030 or 2034, there's a lot to do. And there'll be a lot for us to do as investors. I think consistency is key. I think investors get nervous about changing direction of key high-level policies. I think the private sector is good at, in the context of stability of policies that people can point to that are going to drive volume dynamics of demand. If we take the electric vehicle transition as a good example, clear policy support drive pointing to demand for EVs. Or in the case of renewables, clear objectives that point to an investment requirement and probably longevity of existing assets for life extensions and otherwise. That's really helpful. I think when those things start changing, I think investors start looking over their shoulder about, you know, can I commit to that policy as a basis to support or underwrite an investment that is a long-term investment and will likely outlive any current government? And we have to think in terms of 20, 30, 40 years for the types of projects we invest in. So the kind of disconnect between political cycles and long-term investing is clearly of concern. So stability of policies and direction of travel, which, you know, taking perhaps a step back, and it's easy to be critical of government, I think they've got some real challenges. The UK has been a market leader in terms of, it was the first country to set a net zero 2050 commitment going back to 2008 in the Climate Change Act. We set out some pretty ambitious policies then. So there's been that direction for some time, and there's been some level of consistency there. The detail has moved around a little bit, but as a result, we've got one of the, I think, the second largest offshore wind sector in the world. We have achieved significant reduction in emissions versus 1990 levels as a result of renewables deployment, also industrial industry moving elsewhere in some cases. But there's some positives, and I think we should look to extrapolate those moving forward. And the indications are that is what's happening.
AI is such a huge theme at the moment. I think a lot of end investors would know about the so-called Magnificent Seven stocks and the role that they're playing in developing those technologies. But I imagine there's a whole host of other opportunities if you want to invest in that kind of digital infrastructure that's coming up so rapidly. Can you tell us a bit about, you know, other investments in that area that you think provide a real opportunity?
Certainly. I think it's a really exciting area. I think it's not been an area that's received massive amounts of government support from a revenue perspective. So from the perspective of GCP Info, which we're talking about here today, it hasn't been something that we've necessarily focused on. Gravis does have a digital infrastructure open-ended fund that invests in effectively the plumbing of the internet. And whilst I think those Magnificent Seven are almost the public front of the digitalization trend, there's a huge amount that goes on in the background in terms of the tower businesses, the wire businesses, the data centers, the energy. And I think energy is increasingly a limiting factor on the growth of AI and deployment of AI. We've seen Microsoft and I think Amazon recently looking at nuclear power as a source of energy for their new data centers, which I think points to how much power is needed on a baseload basis to power this transition. And with that comes questions around the grid and the grid's ability to support those things. So I think increasingly, and we've reviewed a number of opportunities for other strategies we manage at Gravis, can we combine energy centres and data centres to effectively provide an all-in product for ultimately the data centre tenants? So I think there are, and I guess that coming back to your question, that Magnificent Seven, from a valuation perspective, you know, I'm probably not qualified to comment. What I can say is relative to some of the more infrastructure-heavy businesses that are necessary to support that, we see an attractive opportunity there. We have the VT Gravis Digital Infrastructure Income Fund that invests in exactly that sort of thing across the world. And there's a balance there between it's, you know, an infrastructure opportunity versus more of a real estate opportunity, and certainly something like data centers have probably spanned both those buckets. But there are certainly the infrastructure of the digitalization trend, which is the plumbing of the internet, plus I would increasingly say the energy system to support it, I think is a really interesting theme moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely. And how big are these businesses? Are they? I mean, would you class them as large caps? Are they smaller?
Many of them are large caps. Okay. We did think about launching a fund once, which is the biggest businesses you've never heard of, and many of them were sort of associated with that transition. A lot of them are very capital intensive businesses that operate globally. So we're not talking about niche players here. And I think that is supported by the size of that market and what's necessary ultimately to deliver what it feels like has become sort of the fourth utility. That data and access to the internet is so key to so many things.
Yeah. Interesting. So over the past year, you know, it's been a challenging environment, I think it's fair to say, for infrastructure funds, but maybe broadly, I think we could say alternative assets. It's been a volatile period. Looking ahead, you know, we expect to see interest rates to come down a bit more globally. There's a bit of inflation risk still on the cards potentially, but what is now a good time to invest in infrastructure in your view?
I think it is. I think if we look at a fund like GCP Infrastructure, it's paid a stable, sustainable dividend for the last 14 years. You can access that dividend today at around a 9% yield on share price.
It's an income play.
It's an income play. And I think that goes to your point around, yes, it has been a challenging time. And I think there's two things that have happened. There's been this paradigm shift in the rate environment, a pretty dramatic, large change pretty quickly to the underlying base rate environment. That has certainly made infrastructure, long-dated income stocks look less attractive on a relative basis. And I think that's a risk we always acknowledged the sector had. In a higher rate environment, relative attractiveness would fall. I think there is another thing going on, which is a flood of capital away from alternative income sources in favor of more traditional sources of fixed income, whether that's gilts, money market funds, bonds. And we've seen them as beneficiaries of this dynamic. But what that's created, I think, is a relatively unique opportunity for funds like GCP. For the majority of our life, we've traded at 5-15 premium. Now you can access us at the 27 discount we're trading, but that implies a yield of 9%, which we think is attractive. Given where the portfolio is, it's a large, mature, operational and diverse portfolio of assets, which I would argue has never been better placed to continue to service that income moving forward. So yes, I think now's a good time to invest. We've also got to acknowledge the challenges that some of our investors have had, and we've been proactively looking for solutions to try and narrow the discount we're trading. We set out in December a capital reallocation program to dispose of assets, and we've disposed of a wind farm in April at a 6% premium to NAVs. And not only does that sort of validate the valuation in the NAV rather than that's perhaps implied by the share price, it also allows us to delever. We've reduced net debt to just under 50 million, so under 5% of total assets. And we've committed to return at least 50 million back to shareholders by way of buybacks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. Phil, all our advisors and wealth managers attending today have been listening to various fund managers and learning about their strategies. But I wanted to kind of turn that question around and ask you, you know, is there something that you've picked up on from a conversation today that's really stuck with you?
I think one of the gentlemen who listened to one of our earlier presentations just made the comment about liquidity in the investment trust space. And I think that's something that we hear time and time again. And we hear challenges of more institutions need to be involved in the space. We need more inclusion in indices that drive liquidity. Investment trusts currently, certainly in the infrastructure space, aren't included in infrastructure indexes.
Say that again, sorry.
So investment trusts that invest in infrastructure like ours are not included in the MSCI, FTSE Russell infrastructure indices, which drive a lot of liquidity where people are buying those in mm-hmm. or products linked to those indexes. Mm-hmm. So there's a few things that we, Gravis and others in the market, are trying to do to address the liquidity point.
Fantastic.
But fundamentally, I think
Fantastic.
That has been a barrier.
Thank you very much
sector.
For joining us today. It's been great
to talk to you. Conversations today. I think the other one on a similar theme is probably cost disclosure. We've made a bit of progress on that, and all credit to Bill McLeod at Gravis and the team that has supported him across the industry in campaigning for cost disclosure to be changed. What that means for investment trusts is the layering of costs that happens or has been happening now no longer has to happen. So I think that's a massive win for the sector. We hope that will wash through the various layers in the system to ultimately provide investors with a fairer reflection of the costs that are being incurred. So that's the other thing that's been reinforced in the discussions today.
From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.